Hi, I'm Sam Seder. This week on Ring of Fire, Holly Breland will join me from Mother Jones Magazine to discuss his piece, Why Are Right-Wing Conspiracies So Obsessed with Pedophilia? Of course, we're getting a bunch of that from Pizzagate to QAnon, and Ollie breaks it down for us, and it's got a long history amongst conservatives, and there's an ideological bent to it. Of course, Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the big news stories of the week. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor and support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we are now... really, I guess less than 6 weeks out from the election. More, well, maybe a little bit. Yeah, no, 6 weeks or so from the election. It'll be 6 weeks, I think, on Tuesday. And things are getting a little bit, obviously, increasingly sort of crazy. We have seen over the past, you know, week or so, various, and we mentioned this, I think, last week. We saw the Wisconsin state Supreme Court weigh in and say the ballots can be sent out, despite the fact that the Green Party was completely inept in trying to get on the ballot and then refused to, for whatever answer an affidavit, and then ended up, just according to them, coincidentally, to getting one of the biggest firms that represents Republicans in the state to basically slow down the sending out of ballots in Wisconsin. Those are going ahead. The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which is a left-leaning court, has extended the ballot deadline. The federal district court found that, yes, you can disenfranchise felons and basically impose a poll tax on them. We had mentioned last week that the state Supreme Courts and the courts in these states are doing things now that are going to have implications later. And that general idea fell under the rubric, if you will, that the Republican strategy, there was an A and B strategy. A was to try and win, and B was to try and undermine the faith in the election and win that way. And the closer we get, the more it looks like maybe I was wrong to say A and B, and it really should be B and A in that order. And we can talk about that, because, you know, this week we saw Bill Barr basically lose it at Hillsdale College about his Justice Department. This is the same week where the Durham investigation really started to disintegrate a little bit in terms of its efficacy as a political instrument. You had Durham's right-hand woman who had been working for him for years, maybe a decade, quit because she felt like that Bill Barr was pressuring Durham and the investigation to come out with the result of their investigation for the sake of the election. Where are we, Digby? I mean, I know it's dark in here, and I know that we're lost, but do you have any general sense of where we are?
Boy, I think what you just said is absolutely correct. And we did talk about this, and I think we did get it backwards, and that's largely a result. I mean, I think we had it right in the beginning that they probably thought, well, we'll try and win the election, and then, you know, if that doesn't work because, you know, for whatever reason, we'll have laid the groundwork for, you know, invalidating the results in some way. But it's really become pretty obvious, I think, at this point, that they're really going with the invalidating the election. Because, look, anybody normal in this situation would be trying to, you know, appeal to more voters than just their base, which is not close to being a majority of the country. And Trump is doubling down on just appealing to his base. I mean, he comes out, he doesn't even make any bones about it anymore, that he is trying to you know, appeal to more people. And in some ways, I mean, he's even, I mean, you know, he's holding these super spreader rallies. He held an indoor rally over the weekend in Nevada. That was absolutely, I mean, it's the most reckless, irresponsible thing you can imagine. And then afterwards, all these people are inside, and even the outdoor rallies are reckless because they're all, you know, just, and these are people, most many of them older, many of them with obvious, you know, comorbidities that make them more likely and vulnerable to the virus. And, you know, they don't wear masks, and they all stand around together for hours and hours, and then he comes out and they start screaming and yelling and cheering, spreading, you know, this is just right. It's a quintessential super spreader event. And he's holding these things, and these people, look, I mean, you know, look, these are adults, they, you know, are doing well. Most of them, there are some kids there, which is unfortunate. But, you know, most of these people, you know, they, I guess they have a right to do this, but they really don't have a right to do it and then go out and spread it to other people. But that's another argument. But he's doing this, and then a reporter asks him at the end of it, well, I mean, you know, what do you think about this, you know, the people not wearing it? He goes, well, I'm fine. I stay far away from everybody. And, you know, and his people just apparently just think that's fine. You know, anything for the king, right? Apparently they're willing to give their lives for him. But that's it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that maybe, you know, on the edges, it would be so easy for him to just take the next 6 weeks and pretend to be a president, right? You know, wear a mask, do some things that, you know, that might actually appeal to a few people on the fringe, on the edge, who, you know, consider themselves Republicans or independents that might say, you know, well, okay, you know, maybe he's all right. He's not doing that. So I think we can only conclude what you just said, which is that they are putting all their chips now on the idea that they're going to contest the election. And it may be that, you know, Trump's plan C, I think, is what, you know, how he's going to handle losing and actually leaving office. I mean, let's, you know, we have all the scenarios of how he might stay in office. What do we do? Does the military come in? You know, all that kind of stuff. But setting that aside, if Trump loses under these circumstances, having set this up as an invalid election, at, you know, that the Democrats stole it, that the whole thing was just absolutely a, you know, a stolen election, and he loses and he leaves office, that leaves him, he is the government in exile then. He's this usurped, you know, leader who was, you know, who actually won and they took it from him and he's out there. And let's just put it this way. He's not going to be Al Gore, okay? He's not going to, you know, withdraw and go teach a class and grow a beard. This guy is going to use that, you know, there's a whole wingnut welfare financial, you know, kind of world out there for him to exploit and use. And God knows what he might do in terms of going around the world and, you know, undermining the, you know, American foreign policy. We can only imagine what this guy might do. But I think that's plan C. So all of that is dependent on laying the groundwork for this election being invalid. And, you know, I think we're seeing that more and more, like, you know, the stuff that Barr was saying.
Well, let me, before you get to Barr. Before you get to Barr, let me just add a subsection to your C. I think he probably also thinks it's his best way to stay out of jail. I don't know if he's right, but you know, if it becomes a politically motivated, prosecution. I mean, let's just for a moment go back 4 years, almost to the day, right? When Comey came out with his letter, they were a couple of weeks off, but I'm quite convinced, and I think Comey, I was convinced at the time, or not, maybe subsequent to the election, and I think Comey more or less confirmed this. I think Comey was talking about that letter because he thought that Donald Trump was going to be prosecuted during the Clinton administration for stuff that was maybe related to his campaign, but probably also just more related to other things involving Donald Trump. You know, maybe money laundering, who knows? But I think he was trying to inoculate the Clinton administration from the idea of this being a political prosecution. Because remember, by the time October rolled around, Donald Trump had already said, you know, we're going to prosecute Hillary Clinton if I get into office. And so I think Comey was trying to sort of just make it seem like the FBI was not being politically motivated, which tells me that, you know, at least there is an understanding in those circles, and I would imagine Trump understands this too, that, you know, nobody wants to be accused of a political prosecution. And so if Donald Trump can set it up as if he is being politically prosecuted, that helps him. But that's just like a subsection of your C. Move on to what you were about to say about Bill Barr.
Yeah, well, I hadn't actually thought of that, although I've written in the past about this sort of inoculation against the political prosecution thing by Trump and the Republicans, you know, doing this endless kind of lock her up stuff, you know, in a way, knowing how the Democrats, you know, what their temperament and psyches tend to be. They, you know, we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to break those norms, you know. So, that's a dynamic I think we're going to have to watch pretty closely. As for Barr, well, I think he's just lost it. I mean, I really do. And this has started, I think maybe he never had it, but he was kind of controlled, at least on some level, before, and kind of, I considered him to be a little bit on the slick side. He was able, he was obviously a somewhat talented lawyer who had learned how to sort of couch what he was saying in kind of broad brush establishmentarian terms where you could, you know, we saw through it. It was pretty obvious that he had Fox News brain rot just by the actions that he was taking. But he had rhetoric that would sort of cover for that. And it started to slip recently pretty badly. I mean, I watched that interview with Wolf Blitzer a couple weeks ago, and I'm going, whoa, you know, he's angry. There's emotion here. He's starting to kind of, and he's letting his Fox News, the Fox News side of himself, slip quite a bit in the way he's talking. And this speech that he gave to Hillsdale, and I got to be honest, I haven't heard the whole speech. I've only read the news reports after it. So, I'm not entirely sure everything that he said, but from what we've gathered from that speech, he basically just let it all hang out. I mean, he is an authoritarian, and, you know, of course, like all authoritarians, he couches it in this, you know, but I am the true believer, the true protector of the rule of law, but they all say that. And, I mean, essentially, I mean, he said some stuff that was just nuts, and it goes with what Trump and much of the right wing are starting to talk about, which is this, they're kind of ginning up the idea that there's going to be, you know, wild, you know, riots in the streets after the election or maybe on election night. They're preparing for it. They're, you know, that Trump has said, he told Jeanine Pirro that, you know, he'd put it down right away. And, you know, he's talking about insurrection and using those terms. And some of the right-wing talkers are doing the same thing. And you've got Barr there talking about sedition. And when I read this last night or a couple nights ago when he was saying this, I went and looked up, you know, what is the Sedition Act? How does that actually work? It's not been invoked very many times. They have used it in recent years. Once was against the, I don't know if you remember those Hatari, it was a right-wing militia group, real nuts. And they used that. Didn't work, by the way. They got off. But the sedition, they charged him with sedition, I'm sorry, and the prosecutors then dropped it. But the sedition requires insurrection as part of the charge, right? So this insurrection idea is circling in those, and it's circling at the highest level of the Justice Department with the, you know, the Attorney General. And he's talking about this publicly, which I find almost unbelievable. But he's saying he instructed his prosecutors to charge protesters with sedition. And, you know, this is basically an attempt to overthrow the government. So some guy in Portland who threw a Molotov cocktail, they're going to charge him with trying to overthrow the government. And, of course, he's saying that this is part of Antifa, which is some big, you know, mastermind organization. And, you know, the FBI director, Chris Wray, was asked about it in testimony this week. And he said, no, there's no organization there. It's more of like a movement, but it's really, you know, yeah, there are people who believe in that stuff, but it's not, there's no real organization. So the attempt to, quote, overthrow the government is, you know, the idea that you could charge someone with that is ridiculous. But that's where their mindset is. And I think that, Barr was reported this week to have tried to find ways to charge the mayors of Seattle and Portland during their whole, you know, the issues after the Black Lives Matter protests, where things, you know, got pretty wild in Seattle and Portland. But, you know, I mean, Seattle and Portland, they're protest cities, right? I mean, this is normal stuff for them. That's the World Trade Organization, you know, the WTO protest took place in Seattle. That was like 20 years ago. I mean, you know, this is just normal stuff for those cities, and they deal with it, and it's fine, and people still live there perfectly happily. But this has, you know, become some kind of a totem to Bill Barr, I think even more than Trump. I think this is Barr's baby. And, you know, he's just ready to use the full force of the federal government, and he's telling his people, and in fact putting them down, saying you don't get to make decisions. He compared them to preschoolers, the local prosecutors, the U.S. attorneys. You know, so you don't get to make these decisions. I make these decisions at the top level.
I wonder if that's him reacting to Durham's lieutenant quitting. Right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
because, I mean, you know, it would make sense. It happens this week. She quit in a fairly public manner. It was reported rather quickly by the Hartford Courier, I think it is, that she was upset about, and this has been going on for weeks, that she's been deliberating over whether she should quit because of pressure from Barr. It sounds like he's, the timing of this is odd because there's no other indication. There's no other ongoing investigation or, you know, there's no other public indication, let's put it that way, of an investigation going on, and no other indication that anybody's bucking him publicly except for out of the Durham, in which, you know, they've put a lot of eggs in that basket, it feels like, and they may have cracked a little bit.
Oh, I think you're right. You know, that hadn't occurred to me, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, here you've got Barr, who is, you know, he's really acting out. I mean, this seems like acting out to me. So he's in a snit because this woman objected to his orders, which are, and from what we understood, what they wanted Durham to do was issue an interim report before the election, and was pushing it pretty hard. Now, there are a couple of things that are interesting here. Number one, there's no report required from John Durham, right? I mean, there's no report that's necessary. He's running a criminal investigation. Normally what you do, and you can look back.
Nobody
does that.
They don't, nobody does that.
That's not done, and it's not right. It's unethical because, you know, the prosecutors, and it was unethical for Comey to do what he did too. You know, I mean, this is like, just shut up. If you're not going to charge somebody, you close the case and say the case has been closed. The end goodbye, whatever. If you are going to charge someone, then you do it. Barr's been shooting off his mouth about that investigation from the beginning. Totally unethical. Prosecutors and the Department of Justice and the Attorney General are not supposed to go out in public and talk about hint broadly. Well, let me just tell you, you know, we've got some pretty important stuff coming down the pike. I mean, you don't do that. You just shut up. And if you look at past political investigations like this, like Scooter Libby, for instance, right? They interviewed all kinds of people. Carl Rove, he was, you know, went before the grand jury. There was all kinds of stuff. There was no report. They didn't do anything. They charged Scooter Libby. That was the end of it. I would love to know what they knew about Karl Rove. Too bad that we don't know exactly what they found out about him, but that's the ethical way you're supposed to play this. And they're not doing that. So there's no report, and I'm sure that what she objected to was, look, we're not finished with this investigation, and then we'll make a charging decision, and once that happens, then we'll charge or we won't charge, and that's the end of it. And Barr is, you know, absolutely pushing hard for an October surprise, obviously, which we've already seen his method of, kind of embellishing and, issuing reports in ways that favor his, favor the Trump administration. So we can only imagine what they're going to do. And to Trump, my God, the hints he's giving out, you know, well, they spied on my campaign and let's just see what happens, you know, so he's expecting something. But this is just completely unethical. And Barr across the board is starting to I feel like he's unraveling a little bit. And you're right, he was in a snit, and that's why he made that remark. And it's, you know, it's completely ridiculous. What's wrong with all these, you know, old guys that are just, you know, completely behaving like children? I mean, this is really what that is.
I mean, that tantrum. It you know, I don't. That's the inter. I mean, it hadn't occurred to me. You know, I think my default assumption with Bill Barr is that he's the only one who's competent in his sort of evil agenda, as it were. I know that's a little bit of hyperbole, but not much.
Really, no.
but and the idea that he would just be, you know, I mean, the only thing I can imagine in him doing that, in terms of it not just being about acting out, but there actually being a sort of strategy behind this, is this could be his mechanism of disciplining these people. He may feel that over the next 6 weeks he needs, and the prosecutions may not be coming, you know, it could be, I mean, let's recall, Heather, that the last time we saw an attorney general or a Department of Justice lean on U.S. attorneys around the country,
yep,
was Karl Rove threatening to fire U.S. attorneys around the country who would not bring him prosecutions of voter fraud. And many of them came back and said, it doesn't exist here. And I don't have any cases to bring you. Well, you know, Bill Barr may be looking to U.S. attorneys to intervene in some type of mail-in voter fraud or protests that have disrupted the count. Or I'm not convinced.
I have no doubt.
That
no doubt.
This isn't part of like him disciplining them. And the threat is, look, if I win, and by I mean Trump, if Trump wins, you're in big trouble. And so you better walk, you better toe the line. This is his way of trying to discipline Durham's right-hand woman who quit without the ability to discipline her because she quit. And so he's basically trying to make, you know, send a message to everybody else. Like, I'm not going to tolerate this for you. I don't think it's going to work. I think if someone's inclined to say, you know, this isn't right, then they're inclined to do that. And they're, you know, but there could be, who knows, low level people who are willing to do his bidding.
Of course there are.
And, you know, we'll see. I mean, that it is, but his getting this way about it is, I don't know. I've always been scared of him, frankly, for quite a while. In fact, I remember the moment when Donald Trump said to Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, people can look this up, go back to where you came from. And I think this is about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I can't remember exactly when. Bill Barr followed up on that like 2 or 3 days later in a speech to some legal institute and said more or less the same thing, but with a little bit of legalese. And I was like, oh, he is not the sort of like old, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, straight down the middle, you know, slightly conservative Republican. This guy is a full on movement guy. Turns out he's also a bit of a theocrat. Hillsdale, people should know, is a not only a right wing college, but a sort of a fundamentalist college that sort of combines biblical studies with studies of the Constitution. And so, this is Mark Levin is a big, supporter of Hillsdale. They pay him a lot of money and they've been doing that for years. I will also add that Mark Levin, when we talked about these right wingers talking about the Insurrection Act, both he and Stone were public about the idea of having to bring out the Insurrection Act. And so, you know, this stuff does not. It's not just a question of it being in the ether. These are all people who I'm quite convinced are in communication with each other. And I can't quite tell what's going on here, but they are setting up predicates and they're setting them up for their people. They're not concerned about the people who are going to be on the other end of this. They just want to make sure that their people support them. They know that even if they only have 40, 45% of the country, if they can motivate 80% of those people to support them fervently, that's better than having 60% of the country and only, you know, 50% of them motivated. That, I mean, people need to understand that calculation when they start talking, when, you know, when we're talking about a voting process that is undoubtedly going to be marred in a myriad of different ways, and moments like, you know, the Brooks Brothers riot, but not wearing Brooks Brothers clothes, you know, like, I don't know, Proud Boys or whomever it's going to be.
Wearing AR-15s is what I actually am concerned with. And in fact, you know, I mean, look, that fervent support among Republican voters, which, you know, remains. Now, we don't know exactly how many still call themselves Republicans. I mean, this is one of the big questions, right? I mean, how many of the self-identified Republicans in 2016 are still self-identified Republicans in 2020? But forgetting that, within the party itself, which is where all the power is and where all, you know, all you have to do is look at what's going on Capitol Hill to see what the dynamic is here. They went, you know, they went and asked a lot of these, you know, the senators in the Republican senators about the super spreader rallies. You know, these people aren't all, you know, idiots like Trump is. You got Josh Hawley. Are you worried about it? He says, no, it doesn't bother me at all. It's fine. They asked Richard Burr in North Carolina if he was worried about what Trump said about going and voting twice just to see if, you know, if the system is working. He said, no, I'm fine with that. People can go do that. You know, they've got Kelly Loeffler, this appointed Georgia senator who's running this time, and she says it's all fake news about the virus. No, none of this is true. Martha McSally screaming at the press. You know, she's the one who's the senator's running in Arizona for reelection, also appointed, and you know, saying you guys are awful. I mean, these people are in the grips of this Trump cult, which is really just the base of the Republican Party, right? They've always been a little nuts, and now they're even more nuts than ever, due to all kinds of propaganda and a willingness to kind and an enjoyment, I will say. If you look at the Trump rallies, they love this stuff. So let's not let them off the hook either. They're not poor little children who've been indoctrinated. They know what they're doing. These voters do. But they are, you know, down the line with Trump on everything he does, including this, you know, this stuff about, you know, the election being crazy, and these and the Republican establishment is just still to this day, with the exception of Mitt Romney, who said something yesterday, you know, poked his head up and said something, you know, rational. They are down the line with him,
yep,
too. I mean, this is part of what is just so unnerving about all this, is that you can see that this, you know, whatever this is, this, you know, Trump is Trump. And I mean, he's not the problem. It's Bill Barr and the Republican establishment that is the problem. I mean, that is starting to really come into focus here.
I mean,
these people will do this regardless of who's at the top, right?
They telegraphed this. This time 4 years ago, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell were just keeping their mouths shut. They would walk right in line. You had about a week-long period of time where some of the Republicans said, I can't abide this guy. That tape that came out, I can't, was it Jason Chaffetz or whatever? Like, I can't look my daughter in the eye. And then apparently figured out a way of doing it in time for the election. But I think, you know, it's scary that they're willing to go along with this in the event that Trump wins. In the event that Trump loses, what's scary to me is the failure of the media. And I'm projecting out forward because I know this is going to be the case. They're barely doing it now for holding these people accountable.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is in the forefront of my mind a little bit because Barr has gone so far off the rails. I'm thinking about, you know, when Barr was nominated, there was a lot of like centrist, even maybe, you know, perceived right now as center left, legal legal types who came out and were like, Bill Barr, the adults are in the room. And, you know, this type of thing. And there is no institutional, and by institutional, I mean like, you know, sort of the media, the conventional wisdom. There is no memory whatsoever. These people, you know, whoever the next person appointed is, if they come out and say, this is, well, this guy is really a straight shooter, everybody's going to have the same sort of like, oh, okay, deference. And, you know, you and I and many others, of course, but we are in the sort of what we used to call like the, you know, the hippies that are being punched. This doesn't make sense to a lot of our listeners now, because that's the sort of ancient history. I think we're you know, that's so far in the rearview mirror. But, you know, there's a lot of these centrists and media types who get it really wrong. And they either get it wrong by, you know, in their assertions, or they get it wrong in terms of like holding people to account. And that's it. And then it just sort of gets, you know, thrown down the memory hole, and there's no... Yep. You know, recollection of, hey, wait a second. I mean, I, you know, my father, fortunately, did not vote for Donald Trump, but he did say, like, I think we'll be all right. The Republicans will rein him in. And, you know,
I think there were a lot of people who thought that.
And I am afraid that even though he would acknowledge now, like, no, I was wrong, that the you know, the day after the Republicans lose, if they lose, everybody's going to snap back to, oh, you know, they're reasonable. They're not completely, they're not complete ciphers and, yep. And liars and authoritarians. And
they learned their lesson. They know now that, you know, the people don't like that. They lost. So, you know, they'll you know, snap back and be the good kind of, you know, nice conservative, rock-ribbed, regular, straight Americans that we know they really are. We know they really aren't.
Right.
And
that's over.
What we know is that the best we can say about them is that they are incredible cowards, every last one of them. That's the best you can say about
them.
And the worst you can say about them is that they actually, you know, kind of dig this, that they're into it, that, you know, this power play on the part of Bill Barr, this kind of stuff. You know, I don't see a lot of discomfort among these Republicans with that. I don't see any. You know, again, it's Mitt Romney, the only one
right.
that ever says anything, and he barely says anything. But, you know, every once in a while he'll say something. But for the most part, these people go right along with it. And the people who don't, you know, the never-Trumpers, the people who whatever, they're not going to be Republicans anymore. They're going to be either independents or, you know, I don't know, maybe they'll just drop into the, you know, rabbit hole and we won't hear from them again. But whatever, they're not going to be in that party. And the people who are, they're bought in. I mean, I don't believe there's any hope for any of them. I mean, I really don't. I think that if, you know, you look at the Joni Ernst or, you know, some of these people, they're all in on Trump. And you know, I honestly, when we look at Bill Barr now, he's a perfect example of this. He was the ultimate establishment guy, right? He'd been attorney general under good old Poppy Bush, right? And remember that back when they were really great, and Brent Scowcroft and all those guys. Well, you know, when you go back and look at Bill Barr's tenure under H.W. Bush, which, you know, I did not do at the time he was appointed and should have, but later went back and looked, he was always an authoritarian ass. I mean, he was reined in at the time by H.W. Bush, who was from a different era, right? I mean, Bill Barr is a guy who, you know, he's a right-wing,
people forget,
hardcore conservative.
He wrote a 10-page memo basically saying that the president's untouchable, and that was his job application. And
it got him the job.
Well, you know, we're just about out of time, but we should also add into this mix, you know, we have a head of Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, who has been found to not be legally installed in that position by the Government Accountability Office. He has been found to be not legally installed in that position by a federal judge. He has blown off a congressional subpoena. And this is the guy who is presumably works with Bill Barr to assemble their federal secret police force. And, you know, a guy who's already in his position illegally doesn't feel like he's got a lot to lose by, you know, doing anything he can to support the president. And I want to say this, which I think is sort of, which I find a little bit, you know, obviously fascinating and disturbing. This Michael Caputo, who was in the news at the beginning of the week, because, or last week, because he was the communications, the director of communications, the head of communications for the Department of Homeland, for the Health and Human Services. He, it was revealed, was attempting to interfere in the mortality reports put out by the CDC. Simultaneously, there are people at the FDA who are complaining that the Department, the Health and Human Services is, you know, irresponsibly loosening the requirements for, well, they're afraid about it for vaccines, but they did it for the testing. That's why we had so many tests that were so inaccurate. And so Caputo did this Facebook live streaming thing over the weekend, last weekend, where he's talking about this insurrection stuff, and he's basically saying to Trump supporters, buy ammo. It's going to go fast. Make sure you get out there and buy ammo. And he sort of conceded, like, at one point during the Facebook Live video, I mean, he's saying all sorts of bat crap crazy stuff. He says, you know, my health is failing, and I'm quite sure that my mental health is also failing. And he had some type of thing where he's talking about, like, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C. and in an apartment and the shadows are very long in here, that type of talk. And, you know, he stepped back from his position this week. And, you know, I mean, it's very hard for me to muster any sympathy for him, as I would, you know, just about any other human being who's not in the administration involved in this type of stuff, you know, promoting essentially COVID deaths. But, my point being that I'm not convinced that all of these people that we're talking about aren't on some type of continuum like Caputo, where they are, these people are, they're both Machiavellian and true believers and just touched enough to actually believe this stuff. Like, I mean, I think it's hard for, you know, you and I to sort of, like, for normal people to sort of wrap their heads around this. But there are maniacs out there, and they have ideologies, and they are maniacal ideologies, and they have the power right now. And they are on the precipice of potentially losing it. And so they're going to use as much of it up as they can to maintain their power. And so this is a scary, scary time.
It really is. And Caputo, you know, I mean, I think he is part of this. I don't think there's any doubt about it. He was at Roger Stone's protege. I mean, think about that. Roger Stone was a clown known for many, many years. Anybody who followed politics knew who Roger Stone was. He was a joke who had been part of a dirty tricks operation, always on the, you know, the fringiest, most ridiculous dirty tricks side of the GOP. He was always involved, but no one ever took him seriously. He helped Donald Trump get elected. Michael Caputo is his protege, and they put him in charge of messaging on the coronavirus. I mean, that is where we are. We have a low level kind of, you know, most hackish, kind of crazy, dirty trickster doing coronavirus messaging and attempting to overrule the CDC and the FDA. I mean, we are down the rabbit hole.
Yep.
You know, I mean, we're in a vortex in the rabbit hole with this stuff. So, I mean, these are the people, and you're absolutely right about power, and you can apply that to people like Joni Ernst. You can apply it to Josh Hawley. You can apply it to Mitch McConnell more than anybody. You know, I don't know if they're as crazy as the rest of these loons that are around the Trump, the Trump orbit or the voters. I don't know if they're as crazy as them. Doesn't matter, because it's all about that power. It's exactly what you're saying. They're doing anything, and they will sell themselves. They have no personal integrity, nothing. They will do whatever it takes to maintain their power. And so these people, I mean, it's a mutual, you know, even if they're not crazy, the fact that they are tolerant of this lunacy and tolerant of this authoritarian, you know, mindset that you see pervading throughout the Republican establishment. You know, they're part of it. It's unforgivable. It is unforgivable. They have to be, you know, they must be shunned.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
if they stay in office, they can never, you know, that would, I mean, I'll spend the rest of my life throwing this back in their face.
Well,
and, you know, not that it matters what I say, but hopefully there will be millions like me who will do that, because it's just, it's unacceptable for them to then come back, as you say, and say, oh, you know, well, all that's over. Thank goodness. That was terrible. I never liked that Donald Trump. And let's get back to, you know, let's talk about tax cuts. No, you know, no, they're gone. They are no longer acceptable members of society. They betrayed everything. And that's Joni Ernst, you know, the crown jewel of the Republican coalition, according to Luke Ressert. So, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, Digby, I hope people remember those words and join in the millions of people who are going to hold these people to account if we are fortunate enough to have the opportunity to hold them to account,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know, running for the exits, as it were. Heather, we will talk again in a week. And when we do, we will be less than 6 weeks out from the election. And hang on, you know, everybody buckle up, and stay aware of what's going on, because this may be one of those instances where people need to mobilize in a very, very quick manner. Heather,
absolutely,
as always, a pleasure, all things considered. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, Sam. I enjoyed it.
For decades now, right-wingers have been obsessed with the idea that there are secret pedophilia rings that they must in some way shatter. We're talking about Pizzagate. We're talking about QAnon and more. Well, here to discuss why that's the case, Ollie Breland from Mother Jones magazine, writing a piece, Why Are Right-Wing Conspiracies So Obsessed with Pedophilia? So, Ollie, obviously, this has been an ongoing phenomena through the Trump administration. And I think, you know, between Pizzagate and between QAnon, that's what made it sort of clear that it was, rather than sort of a one-off, that it was actually a theme. And you went back and traced at least some examples of this, I mean, really, I guess, through the ages. But just lay it out for us, the broad strokes of what we're talking about. This, there seems to be this deep, I guess it's really more a question of when there's air being let out of the tires, this is the weak spot of the tire. And these pedophilia conspiracies tend to be an outlet for some type of political frustration, I guess.
Yeah, I think that is a really good way of looking at it. Like, I think it's politics, like, in some ways are like complicated for like average people to spend time with. And like, it's not beyond the grasp of most people, but like, a lot of people who could like even understand a lot of political, I guess, like arguments and things like that. It's just like, if you don't have the time, this is a much easier way of framing the world. You already know that like molesting children is bad. If your political adversaries are doing it, it's just like a way easier argument and a way easier way to gain ground and like feel justified and feel like you are on the correct side of the political battle and that you are on the side of good and that your adversaries are evil. And yeah, I mean, like you said, this is, been going on since even almost before I think the start of the administration. I want to say that Pizzagate happened kind of like during the campaign still, when the Podesta leaks happened. That was when it came to be. People were rifling through John Podesta's leaked emails and sort of like in almost comical fashion piecing together emails that they thought proved that there was a sex ring being run, a child sex ring being run in the basement of BC Pizza restaurant. I've been there several times. It's just on my own, it's not happening, obviously. But yeah, that's,
well, it turns out
it's an easy way for people.
There's no basement in that pizza restaurant, and B, we should remind people that somebody showed up with a gun
yeah,
to free these child sex slaves that were supposedly in the basement of this pizza place. But, you know, even as I say this, I recall because I had my own run in with Mike Cernovich, who was one of the key promoters of Pizzagate, at least in terms of like, one, you know, names that we would recognize. And even prior to that, one of the things that I had noticed in following the right was, and particularly sort of the alt-right, leveling charges of pedophilia at people. In just sort of like, that was the go-to attack. And sometimes they were serious, or sometimes they were, it was more of just a way of saying, you know, as opposed to saying this person's a jerk or an idiot, they would say he seems like a pedo. And there was clearly some type of obsession coming from there. And your piece lays out a little bit of some of the history that we've had in this country, at least somewhat recent history. And then we'll go into sort of the underpinnings, because on one hand, it's a simple way of making politics more Manichaean, I guess, black and white. In that respect, everybody agrees. A child molester is sort of unequivocally a bad thing. But there's also it also dovetails with a certain sort of political ideology and the anxiety that comes from that. But before we get there, let's talk about some of the sort of like the big stories, because you mentioned the McMartin preschool. Tell us about that. I remember about that as, you know, this was, I guess maybe I was just out of college at that point, but or just about headed into it. But that was a big, big story. Tell people about this, because it happened in the early 80s.
Yeah. So in the early 80s, this sort of like fantastical claim just kind of came seemingly out of nowhere. I mean, as we'll get to later, it wasn't out of nowhere, but like, there was this preschool, I believe, that was in California. I think it was in Manhattan Beach. And all of a sudden, there was that kind of these, you know, just absurd, like large claims about how a child sex ring was being run in the basement of this preschool, and how it wasn't just a sex ring, which would already be obviously just egregious and abhorrent, but it was like a satanic sort of ritualistic cult-like ring. And so the blood of children were being drank. Children were being like hung up in these sorts of like bizarre satanic ways. All sorts of just weird, weird, grotesque things were happening allegedly. But when people actually went back and unpacked the case, there was no real justification in any of these things. Like there was no actual evidence. The children are kind of found to have been coached in a lot of their testimony. There was no evidence of anyone actually being hurt or even like a basement. At some point, some of the claims were like such that like children were being flushed down toilets into secret chambers. Obviously untrue, just like from a physics perspective. And it just got blown out. And the case sort of started with this one parent, who was later found to be diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. They found that her testimony was like pretty unreliable, but like people just sort of got themselves into knots and like thought this was real. And a lot of the nation thought this was real too, as it became national news.
And we had other, and that's just started sort of like a rash of these things too, right? In Massachusetts, in New York City, it started. And I feel like it also, I mean, I can't recall sort of like the context and when this is happening, but I do remember like there seemed to be, it seemed to sort of create this rash of these type of accusations.
Yeah, it did. Even in Nebraska, like there was all sorts of cases, and in almost all of them, I'm sure there were exceptions. They were baseless. There wasn't any sort of like substance to the actual claims. Like there were very few actual convictions. There was very few evidence that any sort of abuse had ever been carried out. It was just kind of out of nowhere.
And so, all right, so let's talk about the sort of psychology that undergirds these. I mean, obviously, if you're a paranoid schizophrenic, you know, it's more difficult to understand, you know, why you know someone would land on a specific charge as opposed to something else. But the real question here is why this has such wide salience in the American population, but, you know, in today's context, even more particularly on the right. I mean, this QAnon thing has been around for a couple of years, but it is, I mean, we're getting to the point where it's really hard to say that this is fringe. I mean, we're getting to the point where it's hard to say this is marginal. We're going to have at least one or two, maybe more, sitting Republican congresspeople after the November election, based upon them winning the primary and then, you know, having no Democratic challengers, who are full-on believers in QAnon. And one of the sort of fundamental building blocks of QAnon is that Donald Trump is in office in part to fight an international pedophile ring. Like, so why is this? I mean, it's funny. It's also terrifying, right? I mean, like, it's bat crap crazy, but it's also a real thing that we have to deal with as a society. Why is this so closely associated with a right-wing movement?
Yeah. So to kind of understand why it's like a right-wing phenomenon now, to just like go back to the 80s one more time, the McMartin trials and all of these other accusations, like the reason they actually didn't come out of nowhere, even though they felt like it at the time, was because people in this era were already primed to be distrustful of daycare centers. They'd been pilloried by the right as sort of like mechanisms that would destroy the nuclear family. They were like a serious threat to the nuclear family. And the other thing that was kind of happening in the 80s was that women were entering the workforce in mass for the first time, not just in like part-time jobs, but like in full-time, like full-on career roles. And this is kind of like, this had been happening, but this is when this is coming to a full head. Daycare centers, as a result, were more necessary than they'd ever been, because in often cases, you had a lot of parents both working full-time jobs. So there was just, they were routinely critiqued as a mechanism like that was really like inherently progressive, which just angered conservatives to no end. And so these actual accusations, when it came down to it, ended up sort of being like a metastasizing of these fears, because they were seen as, whether or not people wanted to acknowledge it, they were seen as inherently progressive because they were helping these sort of like feminist goals of like getting women into the workplace. And when you look to QAnon now and you look to what's happening, this sort of like, it seems almost, ignoring like the kind of Trump bits of it, it almost seems apolitical. And ignoring like the sort of like, I guess the liberal elites being targeted in it. But if you think about it, the way that QAnon operates, it ends up directly attacking like progressive aims, not just like people like Hillary Clinton or George Soros or other people who are seen as like running these pedophile rings, but its followers are often like enabled and mobilized around pretty like explicit like conservative aims. There's this one case in California right now, the state senator Scott Winder, who introduced pro LGBTQ equality legislation that would basically help gay people. So in the way that the law right now is structured, so that if you are like a 17-year-old and you have sex with a 19-year-old, the judge can like use his discretion to be like, okay, these are two consenting people, they're dating, like this is not a case of statutory rape. The judge can like intervene if they want to, but this only works for vaginal penetration, not for digital penetration or anal penetration. So Winer's just trying to like extend out the law so that it applies to anyone, you know, regardless of sexual orientation. He's been attacked by QAnon supporters as enabling pedophilia baselessly. These people are targeting like very directly the businesses too that they target, not just like Comet Ping Pong, which is where Pizzagate happened, but there's also been miniature Pizzagates. They've targeted Voodoo Donuts, which is in the very liberal city of Portland. I think Voodoo's like, whether or not they actually are progressive, they give off a sort of progressive, like young person kind of sheen. They've attacked Sweet Jesus ice cream in Toronto, which again sort of seems progressive and edgy. It is like very much a sort of culture war item from every step of it, both in the businesses that they attack and the policies they attack. all the way up to supporting Donald Trump and attacking liberal elites.
We should say also, it just occurs to me that there was a huge scandal that people may not have been aware of. Their QAnon became convinced that Wayfair, the furniture company, was actually shipping children in the guise of, I can't remember what, some type of couch or some type of furniture line. And there was like the name of the furniture line, you know, coincided, like they were using first names, like, you know, the Ken or the Betty couch or something to that effect. It escapes me the details. But and people, QAnon latched onto this and said, like, there's a Betty that was kidnapped 3 years ago. They are selling this Betty for $22,000. And eventually, you know, Wayfair had to address it and say, no, that we're actually selling furniture. This is actually our furniture. But this notion of it. I mean, because daycare centers, I mean, to be, you know, let's be very clear here. Daycare centers do, and particularly in 1980, you know, I think we have sort of moved on to the basic assumption that they're necessarily going to empower women as opposed to men. We still haven't achieved that level of parity in terms of childcare. But certainly in the context of the early 80s and through the 70s, the notion of daycare is a fundamental empowerment to women who were basically, society had this expectation of women staying at home to take care of the children, and daycare was enabling the emancipation of women and the economic empowerment of women across the country. I mean, so this is. And I don't even, and obviously, like, I don't think these QAnon people or even the conservatives made that direct connection, but that anxiety associated with the idea that the traditional family where the woman is in the kitchen or staying at home to take care of the kids was breaking apart. And this was sort of like a second order, representation. And not just representation, a second order function of that empowerment of women. And it also occurs to me as we talk about this, that during the Chicago teacher strike, I think it was the Chicago's teacher strike, or maybe it was one of the strikes over in the summer of 2017, 2018, there were politicians who were saying that these teacher strikes was probably going to create cases of pedophilia or child molestation because kids were not in school. And it is, and it was a right-wing politician. I mean, so when we see this with QAnon, how much of this do you think, obviously this we're in sort of speculative territory here, but I'm curious as to, because one of the phenomena of QAnon has been that it's rampant on Facebook with a lot of housewives. And I wonder if what we're seeing in QAnon is at least in part this anxiety about society moving forward. And it is sort of an anxiety that has moved into not just the white men who felt like the loss of the patriarchy, but now, largely white women who are also beginning to sort of like, I don't know, feel that challenge of their role.
I would say that that's like a pretty spot on analysis of it. I think similarly, I've also like covered and looked at how QAnon has moved into women dominated wellness influencer and like anti-vaxxer spaces. And if you think about it too, like the beats of the anti-vaccination conspiracy are almost the same as QAnon. These sort of external powerful forces that are beyond our control are coming for our children, and we need to be able to fight them back. It does, like, a lot of people talk about how conspiracy theories are like often adopted by people who are aggrieved and like left out of political systems, and I think that's true, but I also think that like there are clear cases where privileged people who feel as though they're sort of like specific, I guess, like, idea of what culture should be, and their power is being threatened. And so they figure out ways to justify it. And yeah, I do think that, like, certain strains of, like, certain types of white women are like glomming onto it for that reason.
I wonder too, as you bring up that point about vaccinations, if there isn't a, I mean, you know, without getting too psychological in this, but it's hard to not, right? I mean, this isn't, you know, this is not a clear cut case of like a broad social or economic agenda, right? There's no straight line to that here. But it does occur to me that if you were feeling anxious or some measure of anxiety or insecurity about your role in terms of like, you know, should I be a stay at home mom, or is the nuclear family really, you know, the only option we have? And you needed to edify that, protecting your children, right, would, from an immediate threat, would be would really dispel a lot of those questions, right? Because I mean, like, you know, you don't really have to, you don't spend any time contemplating, should I protect my children from this outside threat? And so the idea of vaccinations being problematic, the idea of, you know, pedophilia rings, means that I don't have to do a lot of thinking here. I need to react to protect the kids. And that seems to me to make it much easier. I mean, almost as if there's a quality of like a Munchausen syndrome here on some level.
I think that that's like a very fair way of like summing it up and assessing it. There are like, yeah, the women who I've like seen on Instagram, and this is like a generalization, right? Like I don't have like firm data on the breakdown of who these types of people are, but they are very much like people who do lead like more, I guess, like traditional seeming lives compared to, I guess, like some iterations of like how people live their lives now. And yeah, this is another thing too that QAnon people have like sort of talked about just kind of generally since its advent. Like some of its really, really big influencers have sort of fantasized, and this has trickled down throughout the community, have fantasized that when the storm comes, which is like their version of Day of the Rope, it's when all the liberal elite pedophiles will be arrested and like thrown in jail. They believe that this will like, I don't understand like the technical specifics of how we get to this, but like they believe that this will usher in a new age where like we will return to this reactionary fantasy of the past where men will like be able to, families can be supported off like the single income of a man, and that the nuclear family will be restored. Yeah, just to go back to what you said too, like when you have like a nuclear family, like kids ostensibly can't be molested unless it's happening within the family, which is actually where like it does happen the most. It's within the house, but these people don't want to acknowledge that.
There also seems to be, when you talk about that sort of day of awakening or revelation, I mean, it seems to follow a almost explicit sort of religious storytelling structure.
It does. It is like a very like Revelation Judgment Day style of thinking, but it also, so like it's really hard to understand exactly how anti-Semitic QAnon is, but I would say that it's like uncontroversial and like should be talked about the anti-Semitic strains run through it. And so like while it does exhibit these sort of like religious tones, it also like bears a lot of semblance to Day of the Rope, which is like a big, for anyone who's unfamiliar, which is a big day within like neo-Nazi communities, where they believe that like all of the race traitors, white women who have slept with men of color, people who have like sold them out, and people of color themselves will be like mass executed as like a new white age is ushered in. And then within that too, like that like sounds a lot like their sort of big day of salvation human honors. Within that too, they also, you know, really don't like George Soros. Just in the last couple of days, I've been on Instagram deep dive in QAnon communities, and like I'm just finding all sorts of casual anti-Semitism, just disparaging George Soros. I'm finding the like the sort of them messages, which is like a not so covert way of criticizing Jewish people. So that like runs very deeply through it as well.
Interesting. All right. Well, lastly, let me ask you this. I mean, you've been spending a lot of time in these communities, at least, you know, somewhat less arm's length than many of us. What do you think happens if Donald Trump loses? Does the story fall apart? Does the whole QAnon story fall apart? Or do they just say, we've got to find a way of breaking this pedophile ring and Donald Trump was a false prophet?
Long term, I'm not sure what happens. I don't want to like promise this to anyone who's like banking on this, but like long term, maybe it's like I could see how it would be bad for the theory and like how it might have a hard time moving beyond that. In the short term, I think it's like pretty concerning. I think that I believe her name is Charlotte Alter. She wrote a really good piece in Time magazine where she interviewed a lot of right wingers who ended up being QAnon supporters, I think just by accident in Wisconsin. And they were saying some pretty aggressive stuff about how like hopeless they would be if Donald Trump didn't win. One woman talked about, and I'm sure this is not the prevailing case, but she talked about how she would take her kids into the garage and just turn the car on and let it all go. Yeah. And like, if there's people thinking like that, you also have the sort of inverse problem where like people might like feel as though they want to take things into their own hands. And like, that's the big problem with QAnon, right? Like in saying that people are running a satanic pedophile ring, even if you're not saying like, we should hurt these people, like, it's saying like they're okay to hurt, like they're the epitome of evil. Why would you not kill them? Why would you not attack them?
Right.
And if Donald Trump wins, like that's, I don't know, to me, that's like the biggest concern in the short term.
Ollie, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Very interesting piece.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. Vanity Works. So this is really cool.
Ollie Breland is a writer with Mother Jones magazine. His piece, Why Are Right-Wing Conspiracies So Obsessed with Pedophilia, is available at motherjones.com. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers that converted into members this past week to help support the show. Of course, we're keeping the firewall on the program open through this COVID period and certainly until the election, which, of course, is an urgent need. But if you're listening to the podcast and you're not a member, why not consider becoming one? You'll support the show, you'll keep the show going, and you'll get the member stuff when we put that back behind a paywall. You can go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm. My daily live stream at noon, Eastern, or later as a podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio. Keep your head up, keep your heart strong.